Do you prefer Dr. Bonnie?
Sandy's fine.
Sandy? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, Sandy, it's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for being here. I like I said before we were recording, I was looking at your page on the university website, and there was quite a bit there, and I was really interested in you've done things in a few different areas.
Mm-hmm.
So right now you're the lead for an equity project, essentially.
Yeah. Like, well, I think equity is a good place to frame it.
Yeah.
Maybe also enrichment. So Indigenous Student Achievement Pathways in the College of Arts and Science.
Mm.
So I'm the kind of academic lead for that program.
How's that been?
It's been good. It's been a challenge through COVID. So what we do is we kind of built on the success of the learning communities model, where students can opt to take classes as a cohort. And in the big arts and science learning communities, they're usually in reserve seats in a few large course sections, and then they meet weekly with peer mentors.
Hmm.
So they get to know that group of students who has similar academic interests, and they're in the same classes, and
Right. Really
it's about building community. And so we thought, we have this cohort of students who undergraduate retention was not equal to general population. So how do we build community amongst those Indigenous students? And then also recognizing that there are some barriers to post-secondary access. So a lot of our Indigenous schools in the province are awesome schools, and students are coming away with great learning outcomes, but maybe not having access to things like physics in grade 12. And so that has to do with a teacher capacity problem for science teachers. But it you know, traditionally has closed the doors for a lot of students to get into things like engineering or geology. So we provide some bridging courses. They're called 90 levels. And then we also have first year classes where having a cohort of Indigenous students allows an instructor to teach the subject through a different lens. So Indigenous Studies 107, for example, was designed for the general student population, and it includes a lot of information that our Indigenous student cohort might approach kind of from the other side of the conversation.
Right.
So teaching to that cohort as a small group has led to better success for students in those courses.
I've heard that quite a bit, actually, that just small groups in general have been really successful.
I think so, yeah. And it's interesting because in our end of term surveys, like we offer these courses, we offer some tutorial supports, we have some bursaries. We say, what's the most valuable part of participating in ISAP? And most of them say their peers, right? So anything where you get to know people who, like you, have kind of committed at this point in time to post-secondary education, having that peer support network, I think, is the biggest asset we can give students. And it's hard to get in a class of 500.
Yeah.
People tend to just connect to who they already know or keep their online friends.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in a group that big, like when you're sitting in a lecture hall with hundreds of other kids, it can feel a lot like me and them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and you can't really know your instructor either. So having been, I taught a class at UBC, the biggest class I've ever taught was 350 students. And I think I only talked to four of them one-on-one, right?
Yeah.
And so with ISAP, I teach, you know, my classes are normally 20 to 40 students, and I tend to know everybody's name very soon. And you just get, you're able to be a more responsive teacher in that context.
Mm-hmm.
So it's too bad we can't extend it more broadly, but it's really good that we can to some areas where it makes a difference. And in arts and science, a lot of upper year classes, third and fourth year, you're looking at smaller class sizes.
Right.
But it's that first year challenge to...
Yeah, well, there's just so many kids, right?
Yeah.
And especially when some of them are just taking classes just to take classes. So you have people all over the board. And yeah. So I feel like you get a lot of diverging interests as well, whereas opposed to when you have a small group and more focused cohorts like you're talking about, you can kind of dial into a topic much better, I would imagine.
Yes, definitely. And you can, so it's a little harder online, but in person in a small group, you can watch people's faces and you can
right.
see who's bored and who's really interested in that part of, or that example. And then you can teach to student interests a little bit more, which makes the class more fun, I think, for students, and more interesting for me as well, because the content level of first year classes, and that's all I teach, isn't always very advanced. But it, you know, finding the narrative that connects to students is engrossing art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's when you can get them to internalize something that they're learning too.
Yeah.
It's so much easier.
Yeah.
So you said ISAP? Mm-hmm. Is it what it's called?
Yeah, Indigenous Student Achievement Pathways.
Okay. And is there an end goal for, or is it just to...
For ISAP?
Yeah.
Oh, I think the end goal is to make itself unnecessary. our goal is to give students a really strong start in diverse degree programs. And, you know, eventually we would like to see strong leaders emerging, strong applicants to professional programs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Mm-hmm. And so how did you get involved in that program? What pointed you in that direction?
Yeah. So it's a winding tale. I did a graduate degree in geology at the same time that I was doing some creative writing projects with funding from the Canada Council and Alberta Alliance for the Arts. And then at the end of my degree program, I was married at the time and my husband wanted to do a PhD at UBC where I had done undergrad. So there wasn't really a postdoc opportunity for me there. Mm. And I had these kind of twinned career paths of the arts and the sciences. So we decided to go out there and I did some sessional teaching while working on creative projects. And he began his doctorate in education, and he was specifically looking at cultural impacts on science teaching and learning through their College of Education. And so that conversation was often in our household. And then I was also, you know, with a PhD in science doing literary writing, I ended up putting together a collection that focused on how scientific narratives intersect with personal narratives and meaning making. So it's literary fiction, not science fiction. The cover might confuse you. It's an interesting cover. But that was the idea. And that was my first published book, was kind of looking at these intersections. We ended up moving back to Saskatoon and divorcing and having a child as well. That came before the divorce. So when I went back to kind of looking for full-time work, she was about two, and I was hoping I could get into sessional work again here. And the U of S at the time didn't have any need really in their geology department. But there was a science outreach program that was looking for a coordinator, and it was called Science Ambassador Program. So it matched graduate students in the sciences with northern and remote Indigenous community schools that lacked science teaching capacity. And so that was really fun. Kind of trust in the relationship building between people who are expert teachers in the schools and people who are expert scientists at U of S to, you know, be able to create impactful science teaching experiences for those schools. And that program, I guess there were four schools when I started working with it, and I worked with it for 6 years, and they were up to 13 schools. Wow. And 24 science ambassadors, and it's still going, so it's running through the Division of Science Outreach in Arts and Science. But I got kind of lured away from it. So after I'd been working with science ambassadors, I was then asked to teach a class for ISAP in its second year. And then to do some research for the college around what were the barriers specifically for Indigenous students accessing post-secondary science studies. And then we designed and developed courses to kind of create this access pathway. And somehow that all rolled itself into a job to then lead to that pathway. Yeah. And so it's exciting. The role I have now is it includes some teaching, it includes a lot of coordinating, and then we're also always looking at, you know, what can we do better or develop next. Mm-hmm. So a project we're working on right now is a digital literacy initiative. So we have a lot of students who are mature returning learners. There's some new federal funding models for Indigenous post-secondary students that have kind of opened the doors for greater participation, but a lot of students are in their 30s or 40s and maybe interested in nursing or engineering. And so I don't know, what was your undergraduate? It was in
mine was in psychology.
Psychology.
Yeah.
Okay. So you would have taken some stats and chem, yeah, stuff like that.
Well, I did the arts route, so okay. No chem, but I did unfortunately have to take stats.
Fortunately, it gives you literacy for life.
You know, you're right, because it helps me, because I still do try to read some scientific literature,
mm-hmm.
and I can actually read it now because of those.
Yeah.
So you're right. Yeah. It was fortunately.
I know. It's a lot like push-ups, right? You appreciate the arm strength later, but you don't enjoy them while you're doing them.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you can imagine having been away from that for 10 years and then coming back to it.
It'd be impossible.
Yeah, and coming back to learning management systems and, digital learning technologies have advanced so fast. So we're going to create some kind of jumpstart type workshops. For students who are coming back, and a lot of them have upgraded the content, but not necessarily the modes of learning we're using these days.
Okay.
So, yeah.
What are some of the challenges that you call them mature learners?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what would some of the obstacles be for them?
Huh. Well, so there is that just kind of, I don't think it's entirely true that if you don't use it, you lose it, but you do need to remember how to be a student and how to get your brain back into kind of learning mode.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's an emotional kind of a journey because you're used to being competent in a job or as a parent.
Yeah, I bet.
And then you have to kind of sit down in the seat again, and it takes you back to whatever your high school experience was like, which mm-hmm. for some of us was good, for some of us was not, right? And kind of reposition yourself as a learner. So it's kind of an emotional readjustment for students too, especially if, it's like math skills and things. There's some skill sets that it's super common and socially accepted to just disavow once you're done with school, right?
Yeah.
I don't like math, I'm not doing that anymore. They're like, oh, I want to be a nurse, now I have to do math. So some students, if they encounter that barrier, they give up on big dreams that are very accessible. What if you hadn't pushed through a stats 244? Even if you had to take it 3 times in the scope of a lifetime, you got your psychology degree, it'll take you places you wouldn't get otherwise.
That's true.
So helping students to adjust and succeed and find those experiences as points of empowerment or tools for the future, not just, irritating, demoralizing struggles now.
Do you find that, is there any issues with between, like, their... I don't know if this is even a true concept anymore, but I always heard about fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any issues that way with people just not being able to really to wrap their mind around new subjects as they come back to learning? Or is it more just getting them back into the mode and then they're good?
That's an interesting question. I think all intelligence is fluid, but we know that brains are most plastic under the age of 27,
right? Yeah, fair enough.
And you do learn in a different way. So there's been studies about language acquisition, for example. So kids can learn all kinds of new words almost effortlessly up to about age 7.
Okay.
And then 7 to about 21, they can still learn vocabulary very, very quickly. But adult learners can't easily memorize trivia. So, like, if you think about Thomas the Train, did you age? Okay.
I watched Thomas the Train.
Yeah, so you probably knew all the train cars and details about them and stuff. Or, like, my daughter, Pokemon stuff, she knew all the cards and their powers and their points and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's really random trivia. And at the time, I was thinking, why couldn't she be learning, all of the bivalves throughout the Paleocene or something, that's true.
Yeah.
But she doesn't know it anymore, right? Like, she could learn it all at that age effortlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And now she knows a few of her favorite ones she remembers. But what happens is mature brains learn better in context. So we actually learn better if we know why the term we're learning is going to be useful to us or how it fits within theories or life experiences we've already had. So mature learners actually learn better, in a different way. If you think about first year science courses, it's often like 10 new terms per lecture that you're bombarded with. And there is, it is definitely easier if your brain is 18 or 19 years old to pick that up. But mature learners, we see them succeed on the regular. So I think you have to approach learning from a different way and know why you're doing it, and find ways to connect it to your prior experiences in a way that, I mean, I know when I learn new things now, I'm learning differently than when I used to be able to just go to lecture, take notes, read my notes, and then know it.
Like a sponge. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I should have learned more when I...
Yeah, when you have the opportunity. So if I understand you correctly, when you're younger, it's almost like all your learning doesn't really need proof. You're just soaking it all up and getting it all. And then as you get older, it's almost like the brain is kind of like, hey, do we really need this? I'm trying to figure out... There's an more of an assessment of the value before.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I'm not sure what's going on at the neuron level. I think it has to do with the speed of, you know, neuron plasticity changes in an older or younger brain. But yeah, and up to age 7, I mean, that's kind of when logical reasoning kicks in too. So you can tell kids anything before about 7, they'll believe that an Easter bunny hops around depositing the exact same eggs that they saw at the grocery store, but these ones came from a rabbit because someone told them. And then they get a little older, 7 to 10, and they start wondering. And that's where they often get anxious too, because once you can imagine cause and effect, you can imagine bad things happening as well, right? And then once you get better at that logical reasoning, people can start making sense of their world, right, as young adults and older.
Yeah, and understanding nuance a little bit more too. I remember learning about Piaget's stages of development, and one of the examples that was used was in concrete operations, and I think I can't remember the terms exactly, but just kids at a certain age, it's like if this happens, then this needs to always be the result, and then as you progress and develop a little bit more, you know that if that happens, that's usually the result, but sometimes there's a little bit of nuance and things can change and people are messy, right? Not everything is exactly the same every time.
Yeah, so. Multi-logical reasoning.
Yeah,
and that's interesting, working with kind of equity deserving groups in post-secondary spaces. There's the insider and outsider impacts on cognition. So there's often an insider effect where a student who identifies with the discipline, I don't know who that would be. Think of like a white male student whose dad was a philosopher and he's going into philosophy his profs look like his dad. And they tend to be overconfident. And that actually, you know, increases their risk tolerance on things like multiple choice tests, that gives them an advantage. And then a student who doesn't see those points of similarity tends to be underconfident or have a cognitive burden, downshifting, due to kind of a stereotype effect of feeling that I don't belong, and then it decreases their risk tolerance, increases anxiety, and decreases performance. So that's another reason why, you know, having peers and normalizing the presence of people like you in your post-secondary experience can be really powerful for students. And having a diversity of instructors as well is really important. I went through geology all the way through without having a single female geology professor. So my English prof was female, my art class prof was even one of my biology profs, but none of the geology. I had one external on my doctoral defense committee was female. But, you know, that was a space where I never quite... like, why didn't you go on a research career? Why didn't you do a postdoc? To be honest, I think it did impact what possibilities I saw for myself in those spaces. And all of those women were single and didn't have children. So that, you know, I did want a family and that kind of stuff. And so I think, you know, I could have pushed through, and I did talk to people who told me it's possible to, you know, plot your own chart in these spaces. But I think subliminally there's always an impact about what looks possible and what looks desirable to attain as well, right?
So, well, particularly women pursuing careers and long careers and also wanting families, I imagine a crazy challenge that lots of people are like, it's a pretty recent challenge in society as well, this idea that, just, yeah, because it's really hard to rectify, I think, or to make, and obviously I wouldn't know, because I'm not a woman and I don't have children, but I would imagine it's very, very difficult to not only decide on how much of your life is going to be devoted to your career or academics or the pursuit, and then whether you want a family and kids, and then if you want to do both of them, it'd be almost impossible, I imagine, to do it perfectly, to mold them completely well. So
yeah, well, I think it's interesting because right around the time that like if you do sociological analysis of women's careers in North America, that a lot of women were involved in diverse careers before World War II.
Okay.
And then after World War II, men came back and needed jobs. Mm. And there was a baby boom and all these women with children. And I think that was also when parenting became its most scientific. So I was talking to a woman who was a nurse in Northern Saskatchewan, Leslie McBain, and her job was to fly to Northern communities and push bottle feeding on families.
Really?
Like they had an idea of what was the best way to raise, and they thought, you know, breastfeeding was spreading tuberculosis. And I don't know what, I don't think, you know, bottle formula in 1940, 1950 was anything like it is today. And certainly it wasn't, you know, didn't have the benefits of nursing for parental bonding or nutrition or anything. But there was some really scientific ideas about how to raise children correctly and how to feed them. And I think it kind of came in that post-war period that there was a certain way to parent.
Mm.
And so the idea of like hard to do them both correctly, you know, what is a correct way to parent, you know, the child is safe when they're growing. And, but that's, yeah, certainly a tension a lot of professional women and female students face. And our students who come to ISAP, a lot of them are mature. So in terms of university admissions, that means over 22. So it doesn't always mean you're 40, but we do have people in their 40s. But also 40% of students year over year are parents. And that compares to about 2% of the average first year population on campus. So that kind of expectation that you'll take 5 classes.
So, and, sorry, 40% more each year or 40% of each year?
Of each year.
Okay.
Yeah, if we kind of averaged.
Right, okay.
Yeah, the programs, we're going into our 11th year.
Okay,
so it's sometimes been higher or lower. But a lot of our students are parents, and so that makes, you know, a full-time course load with science classes that have labs really tricky to fit into a schedule and to be a parent as well, right? So. Yeah,
that's,
I think university four-year programs, they were designed thinking of a single male student living in residence, and that's his whole life, and someone else cooks his food and does his laundry even, right? So
that's what it was based around, it's not really designed with other things in mind.
No, so. Yeah. So some of what we do, you know, when we're working with other groups on campus is about advocating for equity and flexibility. And it's interesting to see how COVID suddenly spurred acceptance of flexible learning arrangements and hybrid arrangements, and even a science access prep course in the summer for students whose grade 12 year was interrupted. And, you know, this is all stuff that we've been saying. We have students who've, you know, had unequal opportunities to access our spaces because of all these reasons. But when it infected everybody, suddenly the supports and the programs flowed in.
I was gonna say the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And now they're flowing away again, and we're back.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic. I think it's getting better, and it looks like it's getting better. And I hope it continues to go in the right direction, and not, I hope not too many things are removed, but I think you hit the nail on the head there, that I think when all these parents all of a sudden had their kids at home.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my gosh, it's harder to teach these guys than I thought it was. So I think they're a lot more in favor of these flexibility programs at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's kind of like the same idea of, like we were talking about earlier, of if you're in a lecture, it's me and them. If you're, if your kids are at home and you're having to be a part of teaching them, it's really, it gets right in front of you. You really understand it, right? But then when you send them back to school and they're gone for 6 hours a day and you're gone for 8, and then all of a sudden it's here and there again. It's not, you're not seeing the education up close anymore.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting the kind of career versus parenting. There's a lot of evidence that girls whose mothers have active careers while they're growing up are more likely to be in for more advanced careers and more likely to participate in post-secondary education.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, you're kind of normalizing a different set of expectations for how women interact with the world.
Yeah.
Because of the divorce and because I've been a single parent, my daughter's been fairly involved. You know, it's been hard for me ever to go to a conference without taking her along. And yeah. So she's been to many conferences and she's spent, you know, Saturday afternoons helping me set up some lab gear for a demonstration and things mm-hmm. like that. And she's, you know, if she goes to university, she'll be 100% comfortable in those spaces because yeah. they're spaces where mom works and, you know, she's in and out of when she has days off like this week and things like that.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I could see it being really helpful in a lot of ways too, to tag along with things like that, because it seems to me, I don't interact with a whole lot of kids in my day-to-day life, but it seems like one of the issues that young kids are facing now is a lack of real social connection. And so they're getting social connections on their phone and on social media and stuff like that, but they're not actually having to do the mental jiu-jitsu of having a conversation and figuring out how to just appraise what somebody else is trying to get and what you can give and what you can get and just all these, like, it's really complicated when you think about it to just yeah. go out and interact in the world.
Yeah.
And I would think that tagging along to things that your parents are doing and getting to see them interact with other professionals and other people and other people in the workspace would be helpful to show them too, that, like, listen, you got to go out into the world sometimes and talk with other people and
yeah.
and figure out how to work with others. And
yeah, I think it's been, the digital worlds were creeping up on us already, but COVID really
yeah.
brought it home, right? And you can curate your world so well online. You only talk to the people you want to and go to the sites you want to. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was talking with friends this weekend actually about how we used to watch, like, if you wanted to watch TV and there's like four channels, you just turn it on, see what's there. But it meant that all kinds of people had watched The Nature of Things, for example, because it was what was on, you know. Or lots of people watched Hockey Night in Canada as just a background. But it did mean that on Monday, everybody had a common point of reference.
Right.
And it's really hard now when you're teaching to find like a cultural reference that everybody in the class knows. Because everyone's in different groups and everyone watches their own streaming things that don't necessarily overlap, right? And it's very segregated by age and interest and subgroup of whatever thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it feels as though a common situated experience has kind of been taken away. I would
have never thought about that, yeah.
And COVID really made it extreme. You know, we didn't even talk to our neighbors for a year.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, and it was so weird too, because not only are you not talking to your neighbors, but there was a giant rift that just was created between people too, on all sorts of different areas of the political spectrum. People just stopped talking to each other that way too.
Yeah.
So it became really easy to just fall into a bubble, right?
Yeah, and you can just turn off people you don't agree exactly. with, yeah. right? You don't have to talk it out or work in the same place as them, or yeah,
it's crazy.
Well, hopefully, I hope that schools will be intentional about kind of leading kids out of that. And
I hope so too.
Yeah, I think we're seeing, so we've been back on campus like three academic terms, and I think we're starting to see students, like, there was a period you wouldn't see people in the hallway, because even if they did have something on campus, they'd just come and leave and connect with their world, which was on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
But we're starting to see people like sit on the radiators and chat.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah,
that's
bring good. Him back. So, yeah.
Well, people get, I think people are getting really freaked out about stuff like that, because they, so many people realized how many jobs can be done from home, how much education can be done from home, like how, it's not really necessary to leave your house just for the efficacy of getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also, now coming back into it, people are realizing that it is necessary for the social connection. Like, it,
yeah.
you're so deprived of not seeing those other people. And
well, and, you know, some academic disciplines, it made a huge, huge difference. So the online labs, for example, versus actually being able to look at an organism and
right, dissect yeah.
it. For geology, we used a library of 3D virtual rocks. And so that is not, you know, geology majors, people tend to get attracted to the physicality of the discipline, right? Like the rock, the samples are, they're tactile and they're pretty and you can feel the differences. And then field work, you know, is like really, it's about learning a new language to interpret the world that you're moving through. And people who go into geology tend to be attracted to those things. You know, it's like psychology, you probably started analyzing people around you or having new insights, you know, as you learn the material. So with the virtual rocks, a lot of undergrad geology classes really became trivia, memorizing trivia that didn't connect to tactile or physical spaces. And there's actually been a like, I think it's a 40% decrease in people declaring majors. So yeah, which, you know, in a context where we're going to be adapting to new geohazards and climate change is not the trend we want to see for registration in earth science. But yeah, like I don't think there's any way to replace some of the things we do in person. And, you know, you can learn all the philosophy you want on your own, but do you have the same conversations in a Zoom classroom as you do in person? One person I was talking with said, you know, the one thing you don't have in those spaces is silence. And how impactful silent responses can be, you know, within a conversation. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of benefit to in-person learning if students know why they're there. If they view it as kind of like it was easier and I can get the information and pass the tests with online learning, and they don't see value-added pieces to in-learn. Because I mean, it's 3 years of students who didn't necessarily get value added in person learning experiences.
I had one semester in person.
And it was probably kind of people sat all over the room. It was kind of the mock return to in person. I know the first year we were told, like, you know, we'll be in person, but we'll still use the virtual materials because we don't want people hand sanitizing every time they touch a rock. It's like, why are we here? I tried to make it more meaningful to be there this term. Took them on a tour of the geology basement vaults. I don't know if you would know, there's a double deep basement under the geology building. You know, library stacks that roll and move?
Yeah,
so it's like that with two stories of
drawers. You guys have a secret cave?
Yeah, it's a bat cave. That's awesome. So the students got to go in there and play around.
That's so cool.
Got to do some acid tests and dissolve things. And yeah, make it meaningful, right? If you're going to be in person, use it. So
yeah, you got to make the most of it. I don't know. I'm biased because I love to obviously have conversations with people, but I just, there's few things that I think match up to really sitting down with people and just having conversations, and not even if it's about anything, just being around them, you know? So are you completely back in person now? Like, is there anything that's, I know there's always been online courses, but are there any restrictions still to?
No, we haven't had any guidance, although it's exam period right now on campus and it's dead quiet because a lot of people have opted for remote final exams.
Oh, they can still do that.
Yeah, they can still do that. Yeah, we're back in person. The first year we were back with in-person lectures, we actually still did remote learning communities. So those were a weekly gathering for students in ISAP with Upper Year Indigenous students. And we did that to try and make it as accessible as possible. But I bet if you talk to students from 2 years ago, they wouldn't talk about the great community experience they had. And I've just been reading our end of term surveys, and students are saying that, you know, the biggest benefits they had were participating. We did a collaborative found poetry community action project this spring, and that was one of the things they loved, right? So it was paper and scissors and glue and cutting up old historical documents that misappropriated Indigenous voices, and then, you know, students revoicing them from kind of modern perspective of Treaty 6 relationships. And you know, it was in person and community and collaborative, and that was what, you know, they valued, that and each other. So meeting peers was high on the list. So
very cool. That's interesting. How do you incorporate more, because you have an arts background and you're talking about a literature background, how do you incorporate that into an ISAP in more ways? Sounds like that was a pretty good project, the one you just mentioned.
Yeah, that was amazing. So we have three kind of clusters of classes in ISEP, and one focuses on science that we've been chatting about more, one on social science and humanities. So a lot of those students are interested eventually in doing social work or law or policy development, and then a cohort that's fine and performing arts. And so we try to do community projects that kind of rotate focus. A lot of the administrative work is done. We have a position in ISEP program officer, and I've been really lucky to have some super talented people in that position over the years. So this year, I have Logan Martin Arcand. He's a graduate student in Ed Foundations.
Okay.
And he's a theater artist. So if you Google him up, he has a few plays in production right now.
Wow.
So he's a script writer, but he just recreationally has really enjoyed found poetry. And we've done different projects every year. So we did a collaborative project with an artist in residence who was a stone carver, which I also do. And then also we had a executive assistant in the dean's office, Vanessa Hagen, who's a Cree-Norwegian artist from L'Orange. And so we led a community project carving the Cree syllabics for the 13 lunar cycles into 13 stair treads.
Okay.
That are solid slate. Yeah. And they were pulled out of the Thorvaldsen building, so they came from the chemistry department. They were all worn down. Do you remember those stairs? You did like all wobbly.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, there's still some in the Peter McKinnon building. So so we kind of reclaimed those as markers of time and place. Yeah. And then the next year we had a panel of Indigenous female politicians panel, political studies panel, and a movie presentation about Indigenous women's inherited treaty rights, which was really neat. And so this year, anyways, we kind of thought, what do we want to do? Oh, we also did a bead-in during COVID, which was neat. And actually,
a bead-in,
distributed beading kits to about 200 people, and then had virtual bead-ins.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. But we wanted to do something, bring people back together. The big art projects have been really impactful in kind of changing the space in the college. So at the top of the arts ramp, there's actually a kind of a cluster of artwork that's been produced in collaboration with Indigenous communities. But they're expensive. So you do the collaboration, then you have to finish the project, then you have to install it. So we're kind of looking at, you know, what do we want to prioritize our budget on? So we thought of doing a spoken word thing, and we thought, that's a great idea, but how many students are going to feel brave enough to read poetry? We're all kind of getting out of this social isolation bubble too, or even write poetry, right? And then Logan said, what if it's found poetry? Because then you're kind of presented with the material to play with. And so we thought we'd give that a try, and it's fun because we have an LCD screen, so our installation has just been putting up slides of the poems.
Yeah.
We had 110 submitted from students in the college, which is pretty good. And a lot more people participated and or read them but didn't submit them, upload them. So pretty good reach and participation. And we had a source text presented each day from a different person associated with ISAP. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's so rewarding. And, you know, finishing projects like that is just, there's some kind of relief that is difficult to get from other places.
Yeah. And so as you noted, I'm an artist and a writer, and you get a lot of relief when you finish personal projects.
Yeah.
Right? You put all that time in and then you're done. It's like, phew. But there's this added energy with collaborative projects where, you know, first you have to pitch it and get people's stakes invested. And then you have to you really have to know what you're doing and why, so you can sell it to students to participate and make it meaningful. So then it's kind of at the end when you hear feedback from students saying, you know, I did that one, or this was the best part of my ISAP term. Yeah. You know, it feels really good. It's like we gave a gift to everyone who participated. It kind of feels like, yeah,
that's amazing. Well, it's such a good way, like it's such a good medium for expressing things that you don't know you're thinking about, you know,
found poetry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause kind of what jumps out at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it's also, it's good for everybody involved in that sense too, because, somebody writes it and then they might, or paints or does anything and learn something along the way that way. And then somebody else interprets it. And then if you have somebody else presenting it, then the audience gets to look at it. Like everybody, even though it's one person's work, everybody gets to have something that they get from it.
Yeah.
No two people might have the same takeaway.
Well, two poems got submitted that were the same, mm-hmm. you know, which was neat. And the source texts weren't necessarily artistic. So we had Tennille Campbell submitted the text of Treaty 10.
Okay.
Yeah. So we printed it off and people would kind of have an individual page to read. And I've never sat down and read the whole text of treaty documents before.
I haven't read any of them either.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was really neat. And Logan kind of collaborated, you know, he was the driving force and made it work all through the week. And then he submitted a document for one of the days as well. And it was the Hawthorne Report. So it was written in the 1960s. At the time, it was considered socially progressive, but it was an outsider view of Indigenous community wellness in Saskatchewan. So it was very neat to see students pull it apart, you know, and revoice it from the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, you know, although we're a College of Arts and Science, there's still that heavy emphasis on numerical thinking and proving things with data.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of supremacy of science in academic reasoning. Psychology, I know some people claim is not scientific. I don't know. Did you have a BA, BSc battle going on in the program?
Not that I noticed, but it is an interesting one because I'm not even sure how I feel about it. But I guess my only opinion of it that way would be that there are lots of things that seem that people are trying to quantify that probably just shouldn't be. I don't know if it'd be helpful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so doing a project like that one where we really let kind of more organic or intuitive reasoning drive the discourse was nice. It was nice to feature that. Geology also gets a rap for not being the most scientific of sciences.
Really?
Because traditionally it kind of came from this naturalist armchair thinking about the world. How did the earth form? And how old must the earth be if it takes, you know, 1,000 years for a centimeter of sand to build up on a river bottom?
Right.
And then we're always talking 4.6 billion year time scale. So it is very narrative and the story can change based on evidence and... it's a creative narrative-based science in some ways. Geologic engineering, you know, looking at the strength of a rock to see if you can build on it, that's a more quantified thing. But I think geology as a science actually kind of emerged from a different kind of thinking, more similar to psychology, right? We can't really quantify the emergence of personality disorders or mental wellness, right?
That's interesting. Interesting. I'd never thought about that. Geology that way, but I guess it makes sense too, especially when you're going, when you've got the time frames that are as long as they are in geology, it's just the amount of errors that can just compound it. This is so crazy, right? So
And you know how much evidence is actually preserved from those periods of time to tell the story from. But I think geology, the fun thing about teaching first year geology is that I always get comments from students that it changed the way they think about the world, because we don't have good geology instruction in schools in Saskatchewan. Like, there is an Earth Science 30 class, but it's barely taught. But once you start looking at, you know, landscape features in Saskatchewan as having been carved by a glacier that's been gone for 10,000 years, you know, it changes the way you look at things. And I think the emergence of psychology was similar, right? It kind of went from being possessed or having, you know, moral flaws, understanding that the brain is enacted in human behavior in different ways.
Well, it's amazing to see too, just where like even just the changes in the different sciences and their methodology and theories over time, even if the things now aren't necessarily true, to just see the difference between where they are now and where they came from. Like, you know where like the idea of hysteria came from? My girlfriend and I were talking about this the other day, because she's taking a psych course at Sask Polytech, and I learned this too when I went through. But hysteria came from the idea of somebody being hysterical was, first of all, only women were hysterical, and they were hysterical because it was wholly tied to the menstrual cycle, and particularly it was a uterus that was trying to engulf the rest of the body. Like, it was, women were crazy because their uterus was moving around.
Okay.
And So it's interesting. It's like, obviously, that's like just the thought that only women could be crazy and only because of the uterus is so ludicrous to us now.
Yeah.
And so it's so interesting to see where we've come from, you know?
Yeah. I was reading about Isaac Newton in one of my daughter's books. This wasn't like, it was probably well-researched, but about, so there was kind of the idea that there were four humors and how they're balanced in the Western body affected personality and health and things, right? And then he was an alchemist as well. So he was interested in this idea of spiritual transmutation of matter into other forms of matter. But he tested a bunch of metals on his own humors by eating them systematically, right?
Yeah.
So he ate arsenic until he had sores on his hands. And then he, during the period of time that he ate mercury, he kept notes about how it tasted and stuff. But he developed psychosis and actually thought his little dog, which was named Diamond, apparently was possessed by the devil and it had to be rescued from his fireplace after he... You know, but he, it's so interesting because that was, you know, quite a good time ago, 1400s. But he, you know, they were aware that adding chemicals to the body can change how the body works. And yet nobody thought, you know, drugs or alcohol were creating permanent changes in psychology. It's kind of,
Yeah, it's so nuts. It's, there's so many different things like that. Well, do you know why you say don't blow smoke up my ass?
Nope.
Because I used to do that.
Because that was a treatment?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was one of the... And it's like along the same lines of like bloodletting.
Okay.
And I think smoking at one point in time was prescribed too for a sore throat.
Yeah.
Just crazy.
Yeah.
I
have a friend who's a neurologist. So another challenge we have on campus with students is mental wellness.
Yeah.
And if you read the reports, it appears that mental unwellness has been rising exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just that people are more aware of the challenges they have and more willing to seek help and set up systems to enhance their learning. Like, I think it's about awareness. And I'm sure, you know, there are society-wide stresses that have happened, like COVID, that have had a big impact on wellness lately. But I think a lot of it is people used to really, you know, keep a stiff upper lip and suffer in ways they didn't have to. Where was I going with this? My neurologist friend. So she was saying one of the things that is coming up is increases in adult ADHD diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
And she wonders if actually there's always been a subset of the population more prone to having challenges with attention and hyperactivity, but that at the same time ADHD has been going up in adult populations, smoking has been going down, and nicotine is one of the most effective stimulants. And you know, it's true. My office in the arts tower, the window opens because and it has individual room circulation. That was so profs could smoke.
That's right? Amazing.
You know, we used to smoke on airplanes, smoke at the bar. Even people who didn't smoke in the day would smoke at the bar at night. So we may have actually, you know, changed our social chemistry by cutting out smoking for good health reasons, but it may be resulting in people who have a need for stimulants to regulate thinking not having access to that.
That's so interesting because nicotine gives a really interesting
use has been around, you know, since 1300s. Has been socially very, very common.
And everybody just accepted it. And it does give a pretty amazing level of focus. Like, it's not something where you're like, at least in my experience, you're not all of a sudden like just like zoned in, but it definitely makes it much easier to focus on something. So I could definitely see that. Mental health and wellness too is, are you noticing that in your work, seeing that it's going up?
I think we're seeing more students being proactive about finding solutions. And it's just, we have the vocabulary to talk about it. I think 10 years ago, I probably didn't. There's more social dialogue, more wellness awareness and training. Certainly in geology programs, we were not exposed to anything like that, you know, in prior times. And I think it's pretty rare these days to talk to someone in first year university and have them say, what do you mean depressed, right? Like, it's where we have better social awareness. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I thought for a long time that the rise in mental illness was just access to knowledge. Like, more people knew that I thought it was more people self-diagnosing and then and it was becoming psychosomatic. I'm not sure I think that anymore, but there is there's definitely more access to the know-how to find what might be wrong and how to deal with it and how to go about things. But
yeah, well, and it's kind of disturbing that there are many websites that are, you know, they have a commercial incentive to make you interested in diagnosing your own mental conditions, right? So yeah, people are certainly preying on that awareness, and yeah, that's sad. So I hope that we turn a corner and can start talking more about mental resilience and wellness strategies and have that, you know, have people identifying with their assets and strengths.
Yeah, I hope so too. It, from my perspective, it seems to be going that way. So I like to see that. I'm pretty optimistic about it.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things where you don't want anybody to be suffering in their own mind, right?
Yeah. And we see lots of examples of people who had clear weaknesses but succeeded because they were able to put their assets first, you know, as a point of strength or way to cope. So
yeah,
help people to do that as much as they can. Makes sense.
Yeah. Well, that's all you can do, right? Is look at your strengths and what you're good at and hone in on those. Like, it's okay to have weaknesses, right? And they're not always things that you have to completely get rid of or deal with. Sometimes you just got something that is not amazing about you, and that's the way it is. So
yeah. And one question I often get, people have looked at my website, as you mentioned, is, you know, why are you doing so many different things? So you know, why are you? And I think one strength, I don't know where it came from, but I've never been afraid to do things I'm bad at. Maybe I have two very talented athletic sisters and I'm not in that. So, you know, it's been normal for me to, you know, participate in things that I'm not the best at.
Yeah.
But that also has allowed me to, or given me permission to participate more broadly across disciplines than perfectionists who only do things that they are confident in excelling in. Yeah. So tolerance for people to try things out, I think, is something we should build more intentionally into our systems too. And it does seem to be going the other way where, you know, you can't really play soccer in grade 9 anymore if you haven't been in league soccer all the way from age 5. But how do we create spaces for people to just participate and get the benefits of things, even if they're not the best? Yeah, that would make a healthier world, I think.
I think so too. It's a very fine line to walk too, because there's a lot of areas where competition has been too removed, I think, too.
Oh,
I think it's very, very, very important. I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I don't think I'll get into it. But yeah, there's quite a value in competition, and I think that people forget that sometimes. Yeah. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, and we're at about an hour here.
Sure.
So is there anything that you wanted to touch on, or?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I hope you learned a little bit about who I am and where I'm coming from. And if anyone hears this and has questions about the program, they can feel free to find my USAS website and get in touch. Happy to talk about it. And
perfect.
Yeah.
Well, that was my next question. So I think that was it.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Of course.